Moralite, Kohanim, Bnei Aaron, Hashem said to Moshe, speak to the priests of the Kohanim, the sons of Aaron, and here they gave them the prohibition against being metame oneself, making oneself impure, meaning coming to contact with a deceased body. So it said that this is a prohibition that the Kohanim have, with the exception of the close relative. The relatives mentioned in verse 2, Kim l'sheiro ha-korev elov, to those that are close to him, le'imei el-aviv, le'ibnei, le'bito el-achiv, to the relatives that are immediate, the father, the mother, the son, the daughter, el-achiv, and to the brother. Now the sister is depending on other things, I mean not every sister, and this of course a brother and a sister from the same father. If it's only from the mother, then we say they're not allowed to be metame. It has to be from the brother and the sister from the same father. And again, the sister is only one who has not married. Asher lo heisa le'ish lo yitamo. The sister that is not married, she's the seventh relative. And from here, the expression of lo yitamo means that there's an obligation for a kohen. If the kohen says that I'm different, you know, I don't want to be metame, to get involved and make myself unclean, so we say no, that it's not only that he's permitted to do it, but lo yitamo, that it becomes a positive duty for the kohen to go ahead and to be metame himself. Then there's one more expression used in 4, that lo yitame bal be'amov leheicholo, that there are certain times when the husband cannot render himself impure. That means that if the husband is married in a marriage which the Torah forbids, the kohen married will say a divorcee or another woman that he's not permitted to marry. So then, although the marriage can be legal, because there are different degrees of prohibitions when it comes to marriages. Sometimes you violate a law, but the marriage is still legal. For example, if a kohen would marry a divorcee, is it a legal marriage? Or do we say that the marriage is invalid and it's if just he'd be living without chuppah v'kedushin, so that he doesn't need a divorce? The answer is, it is a legal marriage. And you force the kohen, or you try, he's not supposed to do the aveda, the service, like we wouldn't give him an aliyah in this instance, you're not supposed to. If he marries a grusha, you try to force him or to compel him. Well, here we can't, we don't have power to compel, but at least try to talk him into divorcing the forbidden. But the relationship is a valid marriage. The same is true if he marries, for example, if he marries a woman, in verse 7, if you notice there, it lists the type of relationships that are forbidden for a kohen to marry. Isha, zona, v'chalolo, lo yikochu, it says, a woman who is a zaino, it's not what we would call a prostitute. I mean, there are distinctions in the law of zaino, which we'll explain. V'chalolo, meaning a woman who has profaned the kohuna. How does a woman profane the kohuna? For example, if a kohen will marry a divorcee, and they have a daughter. Now, the daughter is not a mamzeres, she's a legitimate, but the daughter is not allowed to marry a kohen. So this daughter is just as a result of the marriage of the father and mother, she becomes posel for kahuna. So isha grusha meisha, and also a woman who is divorced from her husband. The expression here used is isha grusha meisha lo yikochu. A woman divorced from her husband, the kohen is not allowed to marry. Kikadosh hu lelekov, because he is sacred. Now, who is the kohen restricted? Let us see. He's restricted to certain women that if he would not be a kohen, he would be permitted to marry. If he wouldn't be a kohen, he could marry a chalola, of course. He could even marry a isha zaina if he's not a kohen. He could surely marry an isha grusha if he's not a kohen. But here, being a kohen, he cannot. Now, what constitutes isha zaina? That's a discussion in the Gemara. Now, The idea is, the Gemara says that the Zainah that we're talking about is one that the wedding, that the Kedushin, that the marriage has no validity. We had just spoken about that. Of course, that's one opinion. That means that the marriage is not legally possible. According to some, it only means that even if they made the ceremony and they got married, there is no validity to the marriage. For example, if it's such a relationship which is incestual, which we spoke about in the previous chapters, which the punishment is either a capital punishment, if you are intimate with this person, or if not a capital punishment, there is the chayve krisus. Krisus meaning that the soul is punished. It's through min hashamayim. So such a person, if you marry one of those close relatives, either chayve krisus or chayve misa, which we had listed in the previous chapter, in chapter 20, there the chayve misos and the chayve krisos, like another woman who is married to another man, you could have 10 ceremonies, but obviously it's not valid. Or a sister, these are chayve krisos, or misa, either one, there is no wedding, it can't be. But you do have certain relations, like we're saying, chayve lav, meaning that the Kohen would decide to marry a woman who is a halola, and so on. There the Kedushin would be tofes. Now, getting back to this, this is of course legal, but not to get too involved in it. What it means is that a zayna, a woman, let's take a standard case, if this woman will live with a non-Jew before marriage, she cannot marry a Kohen. Why? Because with this non-Jew, was she permitted to marry? No, she lived with someone who she was not permitted to marry, therefore she can't, she becomes what we call a zayna. If she lives with another person, another Jewish person, out of wedlock, she is not considered a zayna. No, if she lives with 10 other Jewish people out of wedlock, she is not considered, why? Because as long as she could have married legally any one of these people. So there you see the word harlot is not a description in this sense of for the Kohen. It's not considered a zayna. When it says later in speaking about Lesia Kadesha Israel, that the children of Israel, there shouldn't be harlots, there's a different interpretation to the word harlot than there is here to the word zayna. Zayna means that she becomes a zayna if she lives with someone who could not have married her. The Kadesha, according to that, is that she lives indiscriminately with whoever she decides. Even if they are all Jewish, she would be called a Kadesha. Now, we have these cases that come up quite often. Especially in our society, we have these cases that come up quite often. I had a case a number of years ago, about 5-6 years ago, maybe it's more than five now. There were two students living together in Maryland. And this boy, they traditional in a sense, they knew what was going on. And the question was if he had to give her a divorce or not, because would it be like a common law wife, and therefore you would have to give her a divorce. But the problem was that she wanted to marry a Kohen. So to complicate matters at the end. So if he had to give her a divorce, so then she wouldn't be able to end up marrying the Kohen, whereas if they didn't get it necessitate a divorce, the fact that she lived with him out of wedlock would not invalidate her marrying a Kohen. So this was a question that I was called a number about 5 years ago from College Park. So these are restrictions on the Kohanim. The Kohen cannot marry a woman who is a Zona and a Chalola, or a divorced woman. Now, when we say, that going back to our sentence, where it says, lo yitame bal be'amov lehecholo, it means any marriage that he made to a woman that he was forbidden to marry. He married a woman who had relations with a guy, or he married a woman who was a divorcee or a chalola. That Kohen cannot go to her funeral, because the law that he can be metame to the wife is only if there is a true marriage without any taint or stigma. But if the marriage is valid, but it's stigmatized in a sense, the Kohen cannot attend the funeral of that wife. On the first sentence, we say that L'nefesh le'yatame be'amov, Hirsch quotes the following, that this prohibition includes all Kohanim of pure descent, even if they have become unfit for service. For example, if a Kohen is crippled, he's a balmum, he can't do the service in the Beis HaMikdash, so you would think that he's exempt, therefore, from all the laws of the Kohen. That's not true. He's not exempt from the laws of Kehuna. But a Cholol, who there's a question by his descent, so therefore he lost like the whole Kohen character, so he's still called a Kohen Cholol, but he would be able to attend the funeral. Now, this Kohen, when it speaks of the close kin that he could attend the funeral of, in sentence 2, it says, L'sheiro ha'kora ve'lov, the kin that is close to him. If you notice in verse 2, and then it says, mother, father, son, daughter, brother, and limited sister. So you only have 6. Actually, there are 7. A wife. Where is the wife? So the wife is L'sheiro. If you notice the language used, she is the first one. Ki'im L'sheiro, to his kin nearest unto him. So the nearest unto him is a description of all the kin that he mentions, but literally that itself relates to his wife. And we say that she'er zu ishto, nearest to him, the word she'er means ishto, his wife. Now it's interesting, when the laws in chapter 18 are dealing about the relatives, the incestuous relationships that he can't marry, there it uses the expression of she'er, she'er. It says there, ish ish el kol she'er besoro, lo sikrevu legale servo. What does she'er besoro mean? Near of kin. It says she'er, kin, besoro. But it uses two descriptions there. It calls those relations or relatives she'er besoro. And here, when it speaks of the wife, it only uses the expression she'er. It leaves out the word bosor, which means flesh. Why does it use there besoro? And here, it uses only the word she'er. So the idea, Hirsch explains in the following way. She'er here means the wife, because she'er comes from the word the rest, the complement. Wife to the husband is a spiritual and moral complement of a man's human existence. So therefore, it says she'ero, she'er, she's the other half. You always say my better half, she's the other half. So therefore, it uses it like the word shar, she's him, himself. Hakor ve'lov, it says, she's as near to one as she can become to the Kohen. So she's like not just a relative, but she's the other half that is closest to him. Whereas other blood relations are called relations, closeness, besoro, from the flesh, meaning through birth relations, they're called she'or besoro. The wife is not through a birth relationship, but she's through the marriage that she becomes closest, not besoro, but kora ve'lof. The difference is, once the wife and the husband are divorced, so then there's a difference. For other relationships, there remains still death. I mean, a sister is a sister, a mother is a mother, a brother is a brother. That goes all the way there because that's a sorrow. The wife's seor comes because kora ve'lov, because she's near to him. But once she no longer is his wife, she no longer is near to him, she no longer is his complement. So in a sense, the term she'ero ha'kora ve'lov is better than the term she'or besoro. It's closer. But in a sense, because it's closer, it also is related to this relationship. And if this relationship is separated, so then she is no longer his complement. So this is the way Hirsch interprets the expression of Sheiro Hakora Velov. But right after the wife, which is the person itself, the first one mentioned is Le'imei Ula'oviv, the mother and the father. Now here the mother is mentioned first. Now, why is the mother mentioned? Is there a reason, or just picked it at random, why the mother is mentioned before the father? So this is interesting. The commentaries stop on this. The Ramban says the reason why the mother is mentioned first is because, and times have changed. I just want to show you the chronic, because he says women, especially in his time he was judging it, and in the olden days, the longevity of women is less than men. Because women, through the Middle Ages, used to die at a much earlier age than men, through the many plagues, through childbirth and things. It was a fact. Now, however, times have changed. So the Ramban says that the reason why the Torah writes Le'imei, because Noshim Chalushos Betivon Umesis Kedem Anoshim, that women would die before men. That's the way he interpreted this. But on his reason, they ask a question. Fine. That's why it says, Ki'im l'sheiro ha'koro ve'lov. But then if you look a little bit further in the chapter, it speaks about the Kohen Gadol in verse 10. So there, if you look at 21, 10, and 11, it speaks, Va'kohen ha'gadol me'achot. The Kohen, who is the outstanding, the greatest of his brethren, who was anointed, and he wore the garments. So it says in verse 11, Al kol nafshis meis le'yavai. This Kohen Gadol is not allowed to come to any funeral, even le'aviv ulimo lo yitameh. For a father and a mother, he's not allowed to go ahead. We'll see later the rationale. But he's not allowed to go even for a father and a mother. Now here it says le'aviv first. Now, according to the Ramban's reason, why would they write here La'aviv, the father, first? He just said that the mother's always written first. So this is a good question. So the Tosfos Bracha says the following. The idea, I think we may have mentioned that. The mother, we know for sure, is the person's mother. That's 100%. The father, there's no way of knowing 100%. But legally, we determine that it's the person's father because of what reason? How do we know? But we have what the Talmud considered a chazaka. We establish a pattern because in the world, normally, most of the relationship between husband and wife. So that's what we have, a robe. So this robe is valid as if it would be absolute. For example, we even kill because of that. Say, make ovi v'imai. If somebody wounds his father and mother, meis you must, right? He's put to death. So the question comes up, maybe it's not his father. He could always say that it's not his father. So from here, you see that even by an established pattern, which is not visible, but is just accepted as norm, you could even inflict all kinds of capital punishments. For example, if a person will say, kill someone else, he is put to death. Maybe the person he killed was suffering from a deathly disease and he was going to die immediately anyway, so it was like horiges atrefa. So how could you put this fellow to death? So you see that most people are healthy, we assume. Don't have tumors that... So therefore, how could you go ahead? The answer is because the rove is good enough to establish a pattern. So therefore, he answers the following. Here it's speaking about being able, the average Kohen, the average priest, not the high priest, but the average Kohen, is able to defile himself to the relative. Not only, there it says mother first, because it means not only the mother, who is the closest relative, and it's absolutely his mother, but also Le'oviv, he could also defile himself to his father, who we've legally accepted as being his father. Whereas in verse 10, it's speaking differently. In verse 10, it's speaking about the priest who cannot defile himself, the high priest who cannot defile himself. So it reads, not only the father, who is only the father legally established, can't he defile himself? But even the mother, which is absolute, then he still cannot defile himself. That's the way the Tosfos Bracha explains the difference in the language between the Aviv and between the Imo. Now, Hirsch says, for an answer, he says the following. In this verse, in verse 2, the mother is placed before the father. He says, it is in the first place to the moral purity of his mother that he owes his priestly character. Now, he doesn't ask the contradiction, but he just speaks, why is the mother chosen first in verse 2? So he says this idea, because how is he a priest? Because the mother is pure. If the mother would be one of the forbidden women, a zona, a chalala, then he really wouldn't be a pure priest. So it's really the mother's purity that establishes a legitimate priesthood, and therefore, we said, if he was a son from a forbidden marriage, a cholol, he would be able to defile himself. The reason he can't defile himself is because of the purity of the mother. The father is the same kohen in both circumstances. But the difference from a kosher kohen to a cholol, speaking about being able to defile himself, is because this kohen, the proper kohen, had a mother who had this purity, and the priest was able to marry the mother, and therefore he has his priestly character. He doesn't owe it only to the father who's the Kohen, but the fact that he's totally a member of B'nai Aaron is because the mother was such a woman that did not negate or didn't defile this priestly character. So that's why the Pasuk attributes it Le'imo first. That's the way Hirsch wanted to explain the Imo and the Aviv. Now, in addition to this, we find other restrictions that are mentioned. For example, let's say in verse 5 and verse 6, it says that the Kohen shouldn't make any bald place on his head, nor should they shave off the corners of the beard, nor make any cuttings on their body. Now, here we're speaking from very different views. We know that all the same three prohibitions relate not only to a Kohen, but it also relates to a non-priest. We know that a man, Kohen or Levi, or Rishon, doesn't matter, is not allowed to shave with a straight razor where he destroys the roots of the beard. We also know that he is not, as the custom was then, when they had a loss of a close relative, they would tear out clusters of hair. That's Le'ikra Kukorchon. They're not allowed to go and cut themselves and tear their flesh. You still see pictures of the mourning going on. You see the people literally like raking themselves. You're not allowed to do that either, all right? So it's not necessarily the Kohen, but Hirsch goes into a detail that there's a special meaning why it's forbidden to the Kohen. We may get back to that shortly. But there's an interesting interpretation in this point, which the Maril Diskin said, that he especially tells it to the Kohen, because perhaps there used to be, at that time, the Komrei Akum, the priests of the non-Jews, so they would have signs, visible signs, of their priesthood. Perhaps they would go necessarily with a collar like we have, or they would make signs cutting themselves or tearing out their flesh or something of that, and this would be a sign of their priesthood. So Maril Diskin pointed out, and this is true, he says, really, there is no difference from the priest to the average person there. So their priesthood is represented, he says, by exterior showing. But he says, by the Kohen, it's totally different. The Kohen is a holy person. There are certain restrictions that deal with the Kohen's inner sanctity or inner relationship to God, that he eats certain foods, that he can't defile himself. This deals with the spirit of the Kohen. So the greatness of the Kohen or the representation of the priest is not by his outer appearance, but it's rather by his inner personality and his inner character. So he said, so therefore it was written by the Kohen to allude to the fact that if you're using these points as signs of your relationship to God, of your priesthood, that you're not supposed to use. Hirsch, perhaps uses the same concept, but a little bit differently. He wants to say that, first in general, you know, when we go back to the Kohen is holy, like we spoke last week in great detail, holy amongst the people. Wow, but he has certain restrictions. But all of these restrictions are within the holiness that he has in this world. For example, if the person who is deceased is laying without anyone there to help in the burial, so there's a special term that is used for that. That's called the mace mitzvah, meaning there is nobody there. Now, from the word be'amov, if you notice the word used in verse 1, the last word, lo yitameh be'amov. Be'amov means amongst his people. So the Talmud learns out, the Chazal teach us, that when it is be'amov, when the deceased is amongst the people, there are other people there that can take care of the needs, then the Kohen is not permitted. But if it is not be'amov, if it's out in the field someplace, so then even if he is the Kohen Gadol, and as Gemara explains, even if he was a Kohen Gadol, and he was a Nazir, a Nazirite also is not supposed to defile himself, and he was in a hurry, he had to get to the Beis HaMikdash to shecht his Korban Pesach, and if he didn't make it in time, the punishment is a severe punishment. Also, it's the eighth day, and he had to circumcise his son. There's also an Isur Koreh. So here we have a Kohen Gadol who's a Nazir, who has two things to do this day, to circumcise his son, and he has to offer a Korban Pesach. And he's walking along, and he sees a derelict, deceased, drunken, a degenerate person. You could tell the way he's dressed, but he's laying in the middle of the field. So in such a circumstance, the Kohen Gadol has to defile himself and bury this person. So Hirsch points out the very highest goal of all the teachings, of all the mitzvahs, is to train humans to be humane. Now they say, I mean, isn't this a little bit foolish of us to liken ourselves to the angels? We're going to sanctify God just like the angels sanctify God and say, Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. So they ask, so what kind of a connection is it? The answer is that we were given a different mission. We were given the olam, the Kadesh Shimcha. If we would say, Nekadesh Shimcha, we will sanctify thy name the way you are sanctified in the heavens above, then that would be a little bit foolish and preposterous. We're going to sanctify God with the same degree of holiness that the angels who were created holy sanctify his name. How could you even entertain such a foolishness? But the answer is we don't say that. We say, Nekadesh Shimcha bo'elom. The same degree of sanctity that is given to God by the angels above, we will sanctify God's name, ba'olam, in this world. And as we explained last week, the Kedusha is put into this world. So it all goes back to the purpose of mitzvahs. The teaching of all the mitzvahs is to train humans to be humane. And if the Kohen Gadol, who has reached the highest level, doesn't understand or is not required to be humane, this is basically to be humane, and that overrides everything. So this is the message of the mes mitzvah in the kahuna. Now Hirsch speaks also that the idea of the Kohen being restricted, the yikru korcham, has to do also with idolatry. Why? He says, this is a permanent sign. What is the idea? This is a permanent sign when one tears his flesh or tears out hair of the loss of the value of one's own bodily existence by the loss of the departed one. That means I'm nothing already, I'm meaningless. Or rather, as explained there, he said, referring to before, it also is a sign of atonement brought when the idolaters used to do this. This was the form of atonement as brought as homage to the dread power of the gods who are hostile to human life. So those that in the pagan culture, they would worship, this would be the God. God coming and inflicting and showing his strength, and his strength is by death. So you pay homage to this God by just, in a sense, tearing away at life. That was one reason. The other reason he said, which I'll get back to, but let's pursue this for a moment. So then he says, to quote again, antique and modern heathenism like so very much to associate religion and religious matters with death, and this has a relevance to all of us, and thoughts of death. For them it is where man ends that the kingdom of God begins. For them, death and dying are the real manifestations of their Godhead, who to them is a God of death and not of life. Then he says, not so the Jewish priest, because not so is the Jewish teaching of God in the Jewish religion. The God whose name assigns the Jewish priest to his office is a God of life. His sublimest manifestation is the elevating power of life, which frees and raising man to free will and eternal life. That's what it's all about. That's the purpose of this world, to raise man through free will to eternal life. So everything that's emphasized is really the life, he says. Not how one is to die, but how one is to live. How living one has victoriously to conquer death. Death and life. Enslaved by one's physical urges, and one has to live morally free, thinking and so on. So it's a God of life. Therefore, the Kohen is forbidden to do this pagan act, which was that time used as a form of homage to the power of death. But Judaism, basically, the strength of God is v'chai bohem, to live. Now, you'll say, really, this doesn't, he says, antique and modern heathenism. This doesn't, you'll say, involve us. But if we think into it to a degree, it involves us. Because where does everybody, it's a little different twist, but when does everybody turn to religion? At Yahrzeit or Kaddish or Shiva? That's when people begin to think of their religion, right? The average person who doesn't live a traditional observant life. Then everybody comes back. So what are you coming back to God? Only what? To pray to him or to say to him when the moment of death is? Like in Eve, there's a pasuk where they ask him, Hayarech shuacha lo bitzor. Do you represent your pleas and your supplications lo bitzor, not in a deathly or a terrible time, in a time of need. So the idea is that this is human nature, and all of us are that way to a degree. Even those that live a life of v'chai v'hem, but somehow we become a little stronger then, after death. We start. Why do we do that? Because we meditate a little bit. We think. The problem is we don't think before. It's not that we don't have it within us. That makes us and shattered us and makes us think. But to many, it's not that way. To many, this is when the religion is in effect. It's for 12 months and a yahrzeit, and that's it. And Judaism is a far cry from that. That's why Hirsch explains this, I think, in modern heathenism, which to a degree can involve us also. This would be the violation and the prohibition of the Kohen doing that. Now, if you notice in verse 9, it says, Ubas ish Kohen, kisecha liznos, esavia himechaleles. Normally you'll say, a Kohen, how does it really involve a daughter of a Kohen? Daughter of a Kohen doesn't do chen, she really is not, well, certain laws go, a daughter could eat truma when she's still a member of the family, but the daughter is really not a Kohenes, a Kohen per se. She carries a greater burden here. It says that if the daughter of a man that is a priest desecrates herself by immorality. Now, we don't speak about immorality if she is not engaged, but it's speaking that she commits the form of adultery. But this adultery that she commits is the daughter of a priest committing it. So what happens? Be'esh tisoreh, there's capital punishment. Now, for every adultery, there's capital punishment. There's different degrees of capital punishment. There's a more humane type, if you could use that expression, which is called chenek, strangulation, rather than sreifa. But she, being that she was a Kohen's daughter, she carries this extra stigma as an adulteress that her sof is that much more violent, or we'll say punished that much more, although it was in a degree very humane, in a sense, compared to other forms, but it was considered the more severe case. Why? Eso viho hi michaleles, because she is michaleles eso viho. She desecrates her father. What is the meaning of avio himichaleles? So is that an additional punishment? What is the punishment for? Why does she get more of a punishment because she desecrates her father? There are different reasons as to why this punishment should be worse. And also, why does she desecrate her father more than another young lady who grew up in a parent's home desecrates her father? I mean, everybody will say is an act of shame. What's the idea? And what's the expression, kisechel nisnos? What's the word, kisechel? Reb Shlomo Kluger said the following. The word sechel comes, sof ches lamed, comes from initial. So he says, if the first act, she just got married and so on, the first substantial avera that she did was immorality, right? So you can't really say this comes because of her nature, her yetzer hara, because the yetzer hara doesn't work that way. Yetzer hara is a very shrewd, smart inclination. It first gets you to commit a small sin, then another sin, and then a third sin, and finally he comes in with his grand slam. But here, it seems that her initial sin happened to be a great transgression. So why does she have initially? It's not because we'll say she had the Yetzer Hara within her. But there we could also attribute the background of the father. So in a sense, the father was guilty also in not giving her the proper home background. She had the proper home background, she wouldn't have tripped that quickly. But this is a difficult interpretation in my mind. The other answers that they give is because this woman, being that she is a Bas Kohen, more is demanded on her, it seems, correct? Why? Because we have to assume that the being that she's a Bas Kohen, she should have received a stronger, in a sense, a stronger education. So therefore, we expect more from her. Because a person, we know that Kohanim, the Gemara says Kohanim, we're speaking Kohanim at the time of the Beis HaMikdash. Kohanim's Rizimhei. Kohanim, the Gemara says, we're very concerned for every little iota of Aloch, every little aspect and so on. So the house of a Kohen, you could say, would be as sacred as you could expect. And this girl grew up in that type of a house. So since she grew up in that type of a house, we would expect her to have more of a moral constitution, we'll say, because of the fact that she had this type of an upbringing. And she did have this good upbringing, yet she still profaned this upbringing. So in a sense, her desecration was a greater desecration than one who did not have this type of a upbringing. We also look when we see like the higher percentages coming out, not amongst the underprivileged, but coming out in middle class America and so on, where we would think that there is a greater morality. Why? Why? But we are all shocked. Because we would expect more of a child growing up in that situation. So in the same sense, that's what we're saying here. She received that greater upbringing, yet she didn't adhere to it, and it had no effect on her. So therefore, her sin is that much greater, and therefore her punishment is that much greater. That's the way some Bali Musar interpret the idea of Esovio Himichaleles, because he did give her the better, not that he was lacking, but he did give her the better education, and she is profaning that better education.